Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. Disrespect welcomes Anne Larkhard, a mother, businesswoman, advocate, and the founder of DreamWorks to the show. We're going to talk about euthanasia for disabled people and the UN rights for disabled people. Anne, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Okay. What is DreamWorks?
It's actually Special Needs DreamWorks, and
okay.
It's a charity that we started that does three things. First of all, it raises money to distribute 100% of the funds that are raised to the creation of group homes,
mm-hmm.
which are really integrated group homes in community settings, serving the needs of what I would call highly complex, severely challenged young people.
Right.
Who perhaps are at the age where, as young people, they want to have some autonomy and responsibility, but yet require 24/7 support and assistance, direction, or coaching.
Okay.
So we provide the capital to purchase the home, and we've got our first home in Muskoka.
All right.
They provide a therapeutic setting, so the young people are involved in their communities and also have therapeutic services, depending on their individual needs. Special Needs DreamWorks is also a lifeline to parents, social workers, politicians, and media to reach out and speak to people involved in terms of education.
Mm-hmm.
And we're very involved in advocating. So I would call it the underground network of a connection of committed individuals that just put people in touch with the right media or the right political persons,
mm-hmm.
Or sometimes just with another peer or family member that can relate one-to-one in terms of a disability or helping raise a loved one with a disability.
All right. You must walk a fine line as a charitable organization who's charged to advocate.
I don't think I walk any fine line because I speak the truth, and
mm-hmm.
we back everything up with facts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes having a loud voice can be, debatable politically. But when you love and you have the connections that we do to disabled children, in fact, there's absolutely a need to talk loudly.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I guess that's what brings us together on the radio today.
Yeah.
We spoke together about the pending euthanasia legislation in the federal parliament. Now, where is it in the process of becoming law?
Well, I guess that's the magic question.
Oh.
I think there are different degrees of protocol that are being developed legislatively, politically, and then through the medical system. And then once again, through families and religious governing supports that are there for families. So I think there's a direct conflict between what families believe exists and what does exist.
What do you think families believe exists?
I think truly families believe that in the time of crisis, when a loved one is requiring emergency or acute medical care, that it would be a family decision. And if the child is certainly below the age of or mental capability or physically not able to, that the parents would be the governing body that would determine whether there should be supports to the child or a decision should be made with the medical team to let them pass.
Was this ever the case?
That is not clear.
Okay.
I think it's an unspoken and unclear identification of who has the ultimate decision-making.
Hmm. That's disturbing, isn't it?
Well, it's very disturbing because the reason, and I can speak firsthand, my son is 20.
Mm-hmm.
I was told he would not live to be 6 and then 12.
Mm-hmm.
I was asked for last rites. I was asked for autopsy rites. And my son now thrives and does very well, not to the degree that an able-bodied person might compare themselves to, but he walks, he talks. He's autistic, he's bipolar, he's got stress and anxiety, but he is very much a productive person in life and has overcome great challenges. So if we had have not, when he was very small and in hospital, say 18 months to about 6 years old, fought for life-sustaining practices, I don't think he'd be here.
Yeah.
And certainly if you're educated, you're able to advocate for that life even much better, even all the better.
But at least command the respect to the people you're advocating to.
Well, and you know, that respect is a big word because some doctors say no one knows their child better, and they respect that.
Wow.
And others just see fit that they know what will the outcome will be. And so many of these children with unusual circumstances, we don't know what the outcomes will be.
No.
So I think very much there's a bond between a parent and child that goes beyond reading the regular signs, and I think it's, you know, I think it should be left to the family to make the choice ultimately.
What separates the doctors who are presumptive of outcomes and the doctors who think the mother knows best? Do you get any clues?
You know,
or does someone just pull the rug out from under you when your head's turned the other way?
It's a very interesting question, and I've spoken to so many parents across the country about that very issue, and our experience encompassed hospitals both in Canada and the U.S. So in speaking from personal experience, I would say that there's a small group of physicians that don't lose that bedside manner and that sensitivity, that empathy, that EQ, emotional intelligence.
Okay.
And those doctors will really read all of the six senses and the signs.
Okay.
Doctors that are strictly focused on black and white medicine,
yeah,
and percentages,
yeah,
are often the ones that don't really take the time to consider this is a child, it's someone's child, and read all of those, what I will call tangible and intangible signs.
Right.
I think also there's, although I'm, you know, not an eternal optimist, in our case, there's a certain amount of will to live of any person.
Right.
And that will, combined with the love of a parent, can in some circumstances go beyond what is traditional medicine. Perhaps in ways that we don't yet understand.
Well, yeah, when they're very young, children grow very rapidly, and they can compensate tremendously, they can recover tremendously, something that it's apparent to me doctors don't always give them credit for.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I just, there's two sides of euthanasia. I think this recent case where parents were denied the right and a decision was made at the hospital to end a child's life is very disturbing.
Which one was that?
The child at SickKids.
Mm-hmm.
And you, I think you know the family name.
Mm-hmm.
The, you know, I think that the respectful thing to do would be to team and partner with the family,
mm-hmm,
discuss things. But certainly the family has to weigh in. Every family that's gone through acute medical care for severely challenged children or complex special needs children understands the burden on the system.
Mm-hmm.
They understand the financial burden. They understand the emotional burden because they live it. But you have to have respect for a family in choosing what outcome would be best. And there should be a consultative nature to the process. So when you're stripped of that right,
mm-hmm,
it's frankly draconian or unconscionable that a family would not be consulted.
What effect does this legislation have on that relationship? Do we know?
Well, you know, again, an interesting question. I'm not sure we do know. I think that, you know, silently, what is going to happen on the one side is the government. The government and the medical institutions may make decisions on life, particularly of children, which I find very odd.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at some other cases of severely challenged children where parents have taken their life and yet gone to prison.
Yeah.
So, namely Mr. Latimer and others. Mr. Latimer is only a known name because it was in the media.
Right.
I'm sure there are just as many people that do things quietly that aren't in the media, frankly.
Right.
But the issue is that a parent of a child that's below the legal age or is a guardian should have the right to choose. And if our government...
You mean the parent should have the right to put a disabled child to death?
Well, you know, the flip side. There was a recent case... last week in McLean's magazine with a charming 95-year-old woman in good health who wants to be able to choose when it is her time to die.
I've seen it in the newspaper,
And to have someone assist that process.
Yeah.
And she's a full cognitive ability. This woman is an amazing woman from the west of Canada.
Right.
And she's just saying, look, you know, I'm 95, rather than be... you know, debilitated through a stroke or a heart attack, I'd like to choose, and I'd like someone to help me.
Yeah.
So, you know, when abortion first became an issue, and not to compare, but there had to be a long civil rights movement for the right for a woman to choose.
Right.
When the Black movement became afoot in civil rights, there was a long road to helping people to understand what should be in our society.
Right.
And I think that with disabled people, and as more disabled people come out and speak, and more people are touched with relatives and friends that have disabled, and I call it coming out of the closet, people will begin to understand the issues. So I think clearly the right should lay with the family on whatever they choose as an outcome, and that it shouldn't be the government. It shouldn't be legislated, and it shouldn't be a doctor who's known your child for whatever length of time.
Well, let me try and clarify this. Your feeling is that Robert Latimer shouldn't have gone to jail. I'm not putting words in your mouth. That's in the form of a question.
Well, hopefully I won't bear a burden, but yes, that is my feeling. I don't believe Robert Latimer should have gone to jail.
So... if the decision lies solely with the parent, if it's determined, if some other body, a medical body or an investigative body, determines that the death of the child was not warranted, the parent pays no penalty then.
Right. I think that, listen, I was given the choice. My child was in ICU, and... it was very clear, not because they thought my child was going to live. They told me they thought my child would die.
Right.
But it was sort of an unwritten code based on the love and family support and hope and desires that we continue to try to sustain his life. And we did, to great avail.
Right.
However, I have a great deal of empathy for a parent that believes their quality of life of a child is a living hell. And there is no hope of that child not living in pain or having a quality of life. You know, you ask the question, but I say that it has to be a collaborative, and I think that if the doctors together with the family come to a conclusion, that might be a better result. Certainly not a government mandating what can and can't be done.
Mm-hmm.
Although my older son is like Forrest Gump, one of his favorite movies is a Canadian movie we recently caught on television, and he watches it over and over again. And
which one?
I think it's called My Special Child.
Okay.
Or Special Baby.
All right.
A powerful movie, and it's about a family with a child, much like the Latimer's daughter, who's severely challenged with, I believe, spina bifida or cerebral palsy and complex special needs. The whole theme of that movie is at the end, this is a nonverbal child, by the way.
Okay.
But the mother develops a very close bond with the child and is able through body language to understand the needs and wants of that child. The whole premise of that movie is at the towards the end of her life, when she's about 10 or 12 years old.
Who is?
This child in the movie. She doesn't want to live.
And it's apparent that she's not going to live much longer.
And, well, she's in her own way communicating with the mother, who understands that she's lost the will to live, and they should let her go.
Okay.
And inevitably in the movie, they do let her go. And,
okay.
And my son, who's got a cognitive ability of about 7, says it's one of the most beautiful movies he's ever seen.
Ah.
So
is it based on truth?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah, I would imagine if it were, it wouldn't be something that would be advertised.
I think it's probably based on what might be, but it's the truth for a lot of families. And, you know, I questioned my son on that because he's very interesting. And his response was, you know, I think I mentioned that to you earlier. He said very plainly, I can't wait to die. And he's not depressed. He's a very upbeat, happy young man. And he just said, you know, it's so hard on earth. I can't wait to die because I'm sure it'll be easier in heaven.
Yeah.
So, you know, who are we to cast value on life and death as a government? And that's the issue I have. I don't think that a government can make a blanket statement and protocol.
Yeah, so your case then is that as long as the person with a disability is deemed not to be able to make such a decision, his parent can make the decision for him or her.
That is my position, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So when someone has the capability, then your belief would be that the individual with the disability is the person with the right to choose.
Then I think it's like this 95-year-old woman. Then
yeah.
I think it should be the right of the individual, and perhaps in consultation with medical and support, be it family. But I think we have to respect those individuals. And I think we cast value on life. And for anyone that's lived with people with challenges, you know, we have to respect that they have their own, you know, they should have the right. It's a terrible thing to say, but sometimes the life is not a life of quality. It's just not a life of quality.
It's hard for able people to make that decision about someone with a disability. It looks a lot worse from the outside than it usually does from the inside. Now, a statement like your son made is pretty clear, but a lot of people think that it is that the responsibilities of living with a disability are so great that the quality of life can't be there, but they don't have the disabled person's perspective about quality of life.
Very astute comment.
Yeah.
And it's also a North American value.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
So there are many other countries that respect that voice more than North Americans do. So, yes, and it's very easy to look at families who speak these words particularly with their children and say, oh, my gosh, how could they ever do that? Because we love them. And because you see them in pain, either emotionally, physically, or mentally, and it's not an easy life. So, you know, they're not easily taken decisions, but I see the lives that are lived, and I hear the families on the phone in crisis. And I think to some degree, many families, what I see is that without the supports in Canada being offered and the misunderstandings of what some disabilities are, it's a silence, number one. It's a prejudice that exists beneath the surface and a greater than thou when people don't really think and stop to understand and question.
I see.
Does that make sense?
And this looks like break time. Jimmy Thackeray, Empty Arms Motel.
I'm gonna pack up my belongings. I moved out all my clothes. Where I'm gonna stay, heaven only knows. Say that you don't love me, but you and I are through. Trying to sell me misery, but I got news for you. Gonna take myself downtown, baby, watch you down to me. Down at the Empty Arms Motel, baby, where the blues is complimentary. There's clean towels on the rack, a TV and a phone. All the things a good man needs when he's living all alone. Ice machine is busted, there's a blanket on my bed. A hanger for my suit and my people and a pillow for my head. Gonna take myself downtown, baby, watch you down to me. Down at the Empty Arms Motel, now you can get the blues for free.
You've been listening to Single Mother and Corporate President, as well as Advocate for the Disabled, Anne Larcud, talk about her view of the right to choose life or death for disabled children by their parents. So lack of supports not only renders, again, I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but I'm trying to sum up what you said. The lack of supports not only renders the family in crisis, but renders the individual who can't get the supports they need in crisis as well.
Absolutely. Okay. And there are many of those families in day-to-day crisis just barely hanging on.
We interviewed a man who runs an organization in the States, and he is a very pro-life individual, and his feeling was that we must live out the life that's given to us, not like because it's a duty, but we are given a gift. His concern was government as well. He didn't feel it was government's right to take this gift from people. But I don't think he didn't speak on this topic explicitly as I recall, but I don't think he's much in favor of people giving the gift back either.
Well, again, I can't remember his name. I'm sorry. It falls back to choice and who makes that choice. So all I'm saying is,
well, I don't think he was in favor of intervening to prevent them, but his I don't know whether he is or not, but the feeling I got was that his case was persuasive. Is basically, don't give the doctors a tool to take your life by creating a living will, which would probably not be in line with what you're saying.
Well, I have a living will, but I think that listen, when I'm 49, when my son was younger, I fought tooth and nail. I would do anything to sustain his life.
Right.
But I've seen the outcome of living through families across the country that have sustained lives of children that, you know, some very, very sad cases.
Uh-huh.
And what happens is, you know, not only does the child not ever get to a point where they're out of hospital or don't require an acute amount of care or are on a ventilator and brain dead, frankly.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
But the families fall apart. So you don't lose one life.
Yeah.
You lose a few.
Yeah.
Because the family lives with a tremendous guilt. You live with guilt if the child is alive, frankly, that you haven't done enough, and you live with guilt if they're sustained but never. It's like being in a prison. It's hell. So I think clearly for me the choice is that the family together, if the individual has some ability to communicate non-verbally or otherwise,
right,
combined with doctors. At least that's a collaborative approach.
Mm-hmm.
But
how would you legislate something like that, where you have the opportunity to collaborate with the doctors, but then you end up at loggerheads with the doctor, like you get one of these deterministic doctors that you spoke about?
Well, because usually there's a process in a hospital and there's more than one doctor. There's
yeah,
a team,
that's true, yeah.
And there's also a chief of the hospital, and there's protocols and processes to go through so that there's checks and balances.
Right.
There are not checks and balances when you're dealing with a social worker or the government. And I think if Canadians knew today that the government was going to legislate that they can take away your right and determine whether your child should live or die, people, I really don't think Canadians realize that this is the case.
Well, according to the document I've seen, which is to do with the priorities for medical supports, that doctors in Ontario already have the right to refuse supports and bring about the so-called natural death of someone who is relying on supports. And we're trying to clarify that. An advocate who is a friend of the show is trying to clarify that as we speak.
And I think it's prejudicial. Because from what I've seen, first of all, I don't think Canadians know. So I'm glad this show
is taking place
because they don't know. And second of all, I can tell you unequivocally that with the rise in premature babies,
right,
most premature babies and families that I've come into contact with in Canada, the life-sustaining measures are incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So what I see in hospitals and what I hear from families is everything is done to sustain that life,
uh-huh,
even against sometimes families' desires when they're firstborn. And even everyone knows that how we sustain lives that are born sometimes at 4 or 5 months now.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't happen 20 years ago because we didn't have the medical ability.
Yeah.
Now what happens is, once they get through that and you reach 16 months, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 6 years,
mm-hmm,
this is when these decisions are being made quietly and silently.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's prejudicial.
That they're being made without any kind of collaborative or decisive input by the parents.
Absolutely. And if you're going to talk about the worth of a life,
yeah,
how can you differentiate through a government legislation from a baby born at 6 months and the decision to sustain that life from a child who's 18 months when one doctor may think the child may not live and may not walk and may not talk, But what's the difference in the value in the life, and who is the best to make that decision?
And you think this legislation is going to try to deal with that ineptly?
I think that they are, and I'm not sure the political force behind it, the reasoning of making this decision, but I don't know, I don't have the confidence, and I don't have the respect that the right wording in the legislation will exist. So it will be used in a manner that can be different from case to case.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess nobody's responsible if the nobody holds on to the hot potato.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned the UN rights of the disabled, and that's been recently ratified by Minister Lawrence Cannon, but your feeling is that no steps have been taken to determine how it's to be respected.
Absolutely. And Canada's come under fire for being behind many other countries in the world that have not only ratified but have taken the steps necessary to begin a process that will put the charter into action.
Okay.
And it's a very compelling question as to why Canada hasn't done this.
Mm-hmm. We have politicians in the federal government who are familiar with and supportive of disability, and you and I talked about a couple of them. Do you feel there are opposing forces at work there, or it's a kind of inertia, or is it a budget issue? What's going on?
I think it's a budget issue.
Okay.
Which, for a first world country, we talk about quality of life, and I think in Canada we're proud of the quality of life that we have.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think we value disabled lives, and I think we're very... it's a very interesting prejudice that exists because it's below the surface.
So likely the prejudice isn't coming from the finance minister because he has two disabled children himself. So you think this is kind of a civil service thing that's being put over?
Well, I think it's budgetary. And I also think, again, when I say people coming out of the closet and starting to speak up,
yeah.
That's only been happening really in the last 10 years. It's only been in the last 20 years that people have not been institutionalized and that the stigma has been somewhat removed, even from lesser but more obvious and well-known disabilities, where people can feel comfortable with their neighbors or friends or even their workplace
mm-hmm.
to let people know they have a disability
yeah.
that maybe isn't visible to the eye, but they carry with them every day,
yeah.
that they'll be more compassionate and understanding. So I truly think that, one, it's an educational process,
mm-hmm.
and two, it's a budgetary process. But where there's will of mind and political will, then I think it can occur.
Right. So you haven't put your finger on where you think this budgetary opposition originates or how it works.
Well, it's exactly. It's spending priorities. I also think we, in some degree, versus other countries, we have fewer women in our political system. Yeah. I'd probably draw some fire for that comment, too. But I think that when it comes to issues of child care, the disabled, these issues very much where you see countries where there are more females in the political arena get more attention.
Mm-hmm.
So draw your own conclusion, but, you know, isn't it great we have an RDSP where we can put away money for our disabled children? But, I mean, even that's been a long time coming.
Yeah.
So...
no accident came through the Conservatives, though, when we have a finance minister who has direct experience of disability in children.
Well, there's a sensitivity, perhaps.
Yeah.
There's a sensitivity, perhaps, but there's a need for people to speak out. How many people know that about him?
No.
Not very many.
Well, he doesn't put that forward because it's probably in his mind or in his leader's mind, it's probably not a political selling point, although that could change over time, too.
Well, I you know, again, I think he could be a voice.
He could be a voice. Oh, I see. And so he's declined to be. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. And his right, personal matter. But, you know, we need people taking up the voice.
Yeah, if he's going to be a voice, maybe he's a more credible voice if he's perceived as impartial. I don't know. I don't know if that's what he strives for. Maybe he just strives not to make it an issue.
And let's be honest, sometimes the political will doesn't cost as much money as we think. When we're talking about the UN and giving all of the motions to adopt a movement, it's a networking, it's a voice, it's a political will. The actual money to fund different programs, I suppose some of them are costly, but some of them really aren't costly.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of them save as much money as they require. Didn't we talk about that, too?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
You said that people being cared for at home was going to save money, and that the money saved should be put towards more supports for people with disabilities.
Absolutely. And sometimes they're arguing from one pot to the other, or from one pocket to the other. André Marin, the Ombudsman of Ontario, put the government in its place when it said, you know, caring for disabled children at home versus putting them into foster care where the government will pay a third party to care for them is draconian. You're not saying it's the same money. It's not a money argument. It's whether you're taking it out of the right pocket or the left pocket.
Right.
But our government would rather separate families in those very rare extreme cases where there may be a single parent, a requirement of 24/7 round-the-clock care. And I don't want your listeners to think it's a child that's necessarily on a ventilator requiring oxygen. You know, sometimes in the case of our child, it's like having an Alzheimer's patient. He just has no short-term memory.
Right.
He's got the ability of a six-year-old, might forget that you can't put a white plug into a socket.
Right.
Might get up in the middle of the night and take a cab to Pizza Pizza.
Uh-huh.
You know, he requires queuing, coaching, and supervision.
And we're talking now about the provincial government.
Well, both. The provincial government, in terms of the way in which our children, when they have those rare cases that do require that level of care, are not striking in Ontario special needs agreements.
Mm-hmm.
But the federal government, by virtue of our children, are being cared for the wrong ministries. When we have these children, we're being served under welfare and CIS,
mm-hmm.
which is horrible. And I think they'd be better served under the health ministry.
Right. Has anybody raised that issue in the political arena?
Tony Clement raised it when he was Minister of Health in the province.
Okay, but didn't get the opportunity to pursue it.
Not yet.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that's one of the steps that you might see following from ratification if the politicians involved pick up the string, follow it to its conclusion.
And even that, again, back to respect. I'd rather be dealing with a doctor who would, you know, in some cases, when you're dealing with social workers, one who might have 50 people in her caseload, and they're used to dealing with parents who are not able, willing, or, you know, have issues where they can't look after their children, and then they're put in cases where they have these loving parents who desperately are trying to find care and services to be able to care for our children. They don't have the education to deal with these special needs.
Yeah.
So I guess the government feels they can make a decision on ending lives, they can make a decision on where we should raise our children, and at the end of the day, what they were telling some families is it doesn't matter if it costs the same money, it's easier for us to put them with another family than keep families together.
Yeah.
So if your outside listeners think it was terrible to institutionalize children, which I think it was, they should know that the government's doing worse because they're now breaking families up that want to be together.
Yeah, for sure. Well, it's a question that anybody could take to the next provincial and the next federal election, both of which appear to be on the horizon.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Was there anything else you wanted to say about this? Maybe sum it up or highlight a particular point before we close?
Well, you know, I thank you for the opportunity. You know, I'd like to see Canada as a country and Ontario as a country that values people that are challenged, and that we're looked at a country that's revered. And first, it's an attitude. Second, it's a value. I'd like to see it 50 years from now, perhaps we look back and say we were a model, not just in our economy, but in the way that we listened and changed our country and respect those people in whatever disability they have.
Yeah, so an opportunity lies before us that we have to pick up.
Yeah.
Thanks, Anne.
Well, my pleasure.
Okay.
My pleasure.
Appreciate you taking the time on your weekend for the interview.
Thank you. Well, it's my pleasure, and appreciate your show and that you're helping people to understand and have that little bit more in terms of an understanding of where families are at.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay, hope you have a great weekend.
And now it's time for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. The stories we read to you are not the full stories. They're abridgments or condensations of the stories that you find in the papers. For the full story, go to the papers that we mention in the broadcast. Top of news, of course, and 5 days old, is the American healthcare budget passed. U.S. Congress has approved sweeping healthcare reform, America's most dramatic and contentious social welfare change in decades that may define Barack Obama's presidency. This from the Globe and Mail, Paul Coring, the Washington correspondent. In the closing debate, at the end of a drama-filled evening, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, a California Democrat, said the reforms will unleash greater mobility and economic freedom. Americans will be able to change jobs without losing health insurance, she said. The reforms will make health care affordable for the middle class. In Ontario, the news is about the provincial budget released today from the Globe and Mail. Karen Hallett in Toronto, Ontario warned not to follow Alberta example. Ontario must resist the temptation to use Alberta's record-breaking deficit as political cover to go deeper into the red, as it confronts much bigger challenges than the resource-rich provinces, economists say. All but one of Canada's provinces are heading into the budget season deep in deficit. Saskatchewan is the exception. While Ontario, Alberta, and British Columbia are the hardest hit, Canada's largest province is in a league of its own. Not only is Ontario's deficit forecast to hit $24.7 billion in the fiscal year ending March 31st, eclipsing other regions, it also accounts for the largest share of economic output at just over 4% of gross domestic product. Finance Minister in the three provinces have promised restraint, but Alberta's Ted Morton revealed just how difficult it is to practice what governments preach. Alberta unveiled a budget that will ramp up spending on health care and education, pushing its deficit to a historic high of $4.7 billion. Alberta's spending should not set a precedent for other provinces, said Douglas Porter, deputy chief economist at the Bank of Montreal. The economy in Alberta, like other resource-rich provinces, will rebound when commodity prices rise again. But Mr. Porter said Ontario will take much longer to recover from the worst economic downturn in a generation because its manufacturing heartland is undergoing significant change. I doubt Alberta is going to serve as a very good guide for the rest of the country, Mr. Porter said. Ontario Finance Minister Dwight Duncan, who plans to release his budget today, is likely to preserve funding for priority areas such as health care and education while avoiding spending cuts in other areas that could jeopardize the economy's fragile recovery. This is precisely the course economists have advised him to follow. And from the Canadian Press, with files from Romina Moreno, read Duncan's lips, no tax surprises. By Maria Babbage. Toronto. Ontario taxpayers won't be hit by any new tax surprises in Thursday's budget, Finance Minister Dwight Duncan said. There won't be anything in the budget about asset sales either, he said, even though the government is looking at all options to help pay down an unprecedented $25 billion deficit. Premier Dalton McGuinty said taxpayers shouldn't hold their breath for more tax cuts beyond the one that took effect in January as part of the tax harmonization package. As of January 1st, the provincial rate on the first $37,106 of taxable personal income fell to 5.05% from 6.05%. Merging the 5% federal GST with the 8% Ontario sales tax starting July 1st may help to slay the deficit as it will increase the cost of many items currently exempted from the provincial levy. The Liberals haven't ruled out the possible sale of assets such as the Liquor Control Board of Ontario or the Ontario Lottery and Gaming Corporation as they try to close the gap between how much they spend and how much they're taking in. They're looking at options that range from privatization of Crown corporations to bundling several assets into a corporation and selling off shares. Thursday's budget is also expected to provide a roadmap for the government to rebalance the books, which will be awash in red ink for more than 5 years. The Liberals say they won't bring in any new taxes, but they can't be trusted, given that just last week the government quietly created a new conservation tax on hydro bills, said opposition leader Tim Hudak. I mean, come on. They just introduced a new tax increase this week, and we had to raise it in the House today, he said. There's a $53 million tax increase that Dalton McGuinty tried to slip through. Who knows what else he's got up his sleeve. And from the Globe and Mail, Adam Radwanski. March 22nd, Monday. Questions about deficit loom large over Thursday's provincial budget. Facing a cash crunch, Dalton McGuinty's Liberals have lowered expectations in advance of Thursday's budget. Few new big policies that weren't already announced in this month's speech from the throne. Nothing too dramatic to balance the books in a hurry, steady as she goes. But Finance Minister Dwight Duncan doesn't have the luxury of being entirely boring because there are a few big questions, mostly related to the scale of the provincial deficit and how the Liberals will fight it. The answers will help tell the story of the rest of Mr. McGuinty's second term. How deep and how long? If governments have taught us anything over the past couple of years, it's to not put too much faith in the accuracy of their deficit projections. The $24.7 billion that Mr. Duncan forecast last fall doesn't seem too far off, but it's unlikely to prove spot on. The 2009-10 figure, though, is really the least of the government's worries. Getting rid of the deficit entirely will be much harder. That's why observers will be trying to figure out just how big the structural deficit really is. And it's why Mr. Duncan, who's not about to announce tax increases or spending cuts, will forecast a very gradual return to balance. Whose belts will be tightened? The Liberals want to show they take the deficit seriously, but like most governments, they don't believe the public is ready to make major sacrifices to get rid of it. The result will likely be a couple of showy nods towards restraint, mostly aimed at the public service, which will have mostly symbolic value. What about health care? It's no secret that health costs, soon to take up half of program spending, represent the government's biggest long-term challenge. The Liberals have only recently begun to talk seriously in public about it, floating ideas about changing the ways hospitals are funded. But it's doubtful they'll want to do anything too controversial until after the next election. The only immediate reforms Mr. Duncan is likely to tout involve the pharmaceuticals industry. Still, there will be indicators of what else might lie ahead. By their own law, the Liberals are required to provide expenditure forecasts for 3 years. The amount that projected growth is down from the 6% that's become the annual standard should give some hint of the heavy lifting to come. Spare some change. Mr. Duncan probably won't announce any major new expenditures we haven't already heard about, but he'll need to elaborate on promises made in the throne speech, particularly on post-secondary education, which pledged 20,000 new college and university spots, more foreign students, and a new online university. The Liberals don't intend to actually pay for most of those initiatives until their third term, if they get one, but they'll at least need to lay out ballpark figures for what they'll cost. Meanwhile, the government will also have to answer a lingering question surrounding its early learning project. Will it provide extra funding to avoid existing daycares being put out of business by full-day kindergarten? And last, what will Tim Hudak say? This one isn't up to Mr. Duncan to answer, but it will still be an important part of the story. Under Mr. Hudak, the opposition has gotten much more disciplined, planning out strategy weeks or months in advance and sticking to plan. But the Conservative leader also needs to show that he can think on his feet, providing smart critiques of new government policies, and this will be his best opportunity so far to do so. Canadian press again. No author attribution, tasers for first response police officers. Ontario looking to overhaul existing guidelines on who has access to stun guns. Ontario is poised to revamp its guidelines on the use of stun guns by police. The Canadian press has learned the changes are expected to be made public March 30th, sources say, about 2 years after the governing Liberals launched a review of taser use in the province. Currently, only tactical officers and supervisors are allowed to carry tasers in Ontario, but the government is being urged to make them available to all frontline police officers. It's among the recommendations made by the Police Standards Advisory Committee, a group of representatives from police groups and municipalities within the ministry tasked with providing advice to the government about the use of stun guns. Police organizations have long advocated for all uniformed police officers to be allowed to carry stun guns, otherwise known as conducted energy weapons, CEWs, arguing they're less lethal than guns and will save lives. Uniformed police, rather than supervisors or tactical officers, are usually the first on the scene, said Larry Molyneux, president of the Police Association of Ontario. In some rural areas of the provinces, it can take up to an hour to respond to a call. So what we want is the first responding officer to have the option of using the CEW. Some critics complain that tasers are being used by police to subdue uncooperative people even when they don't pose a threat, while others maintain they're a useful tool if officers are properly trained and held accountable. The bottom line is that stun guns can kill, and the government must be cautious in deciding whether to expand their use, said NDP Justice critic Peter Cormos. We still don't know enough about when tasers are lethal, he said. And again, the Canadian press. Montreal washes hands of protesters' mask ban. The question of whether protesters should be barred from wearing face masks is pitting civil libertarians against Montreal's police force, and the cops appear to be losing. City Hall has washed its hands of the issue just 1 year after floating the idea of a mask ban. No other Canadian city has such a bylaw, and civil liberties organizations say unmasking protesters is an affront to freedom of expression. Such a move would have had Montreal following in the footsteps of some foreign jurisdictions, including New York City, where a bylaw banning masks has been in effect since 1845. Last year, France prohibited protesters from wearing masks after particularly violent clashes during a NATO summit between black-clad protesters and French police. Laurie Montsebraten in The Star, childcare collapse coming. The loss of $63.5 million in federal child care cash next month, plus the fall launch of all-day kindergarten for 4- and 5-year-olds, is a formula for a catastrophic collapse in Ontario's child care system, advocates warn. If Queen's Park doesn't replace the federal money in Thursday's budget, they say at least 7,600 subsidized child care spaces will disappear, fees will rise, and parents may not be able to work. Provincial officials say up to 48% of childcare centres across Ontario will lose 4- and 5-year-olds when the first phase of all-day kindergarten rolls out next fall. Most of those centres have waiting lists for younger children and could use the space to expand, but few parents can afford full fees of $1,200 monthly or more. And without new subsidies, centres will be forced to lay off staff or close, putting more spaces at risk. Said noted researcher Kerry McQuaig of Better Child Care Education, every other province in Canada has managed the loss of federal child care funding without cutting services. Many are also investing in all-day kindergarten programs. When the Liberals introduced all-day learning, they promised to reinvest child care funding for 4- and 5-year-olds back into the system, she said. If they don't, they'll be using child care to pay for their early learning plan. And that's not what they told people they were going to do. And more local bad news for families in Hamilton. This by Denise Davey in The Spectator. Up to 9-year wait for subsidized housing in the city. For 6 years, Sina Gulabzada, her husband and their 7 children have been crowded into a small 3-bedroom apartment. At night, Sima sleeps in the living room with 2 of her daughters. Her husband shares a bedroom with some of their sons. The rent of $950 per month plus utilities eats up more than half of what her husband receives from the Ontario Disability Support Program. They applied for subsidized housing 6 years ago, but have been told they have to wait several more years because of the shortage of units for large families. This is a big problem for my family, said Seema, who moved here from Afghanistan 6 years ago. At night, I'm very sad. I feel depressed. Large families such as the Gulabzadas face the longest waits of any group for subsidized housing in Hamilton. They can wait up to 9 years because of the 14,415 subsidized units available. Only 502 are four-bedroom and 78 five-bedroom units. For subsidized housing in Hamilton, there are now more than 5,100 applicants. About 2,400 are families, 2,000 are couples without children or singles, and the rest are seniors. The shortest waits, about 2 years, are for single units in the downtown. "All we keep doing is loading more people on the bus, and nobody's getting off at the other end," said Hubers. Sounds to me like a merry-go-round, as in round table. The Ministry of Housing and Municipal Affairs has increased the amount of money available to Hamiltonians facing eviction for not being able to pay their rent. The Provincial Rent Bank is providing $195,000 to Hamilton for 2010, up from $130,000 last year. Tenants can apply for a maximum of 2 months' rent. Each municipality determines client eligibility. For more information, contact the Housing Help Center at 905-526-8100. I recall that they didn't have any choice in turning away people whose living expenses had risen over the past 18 years above their declining fixed incomes. And that was in the building housing, the Housing Help Center. They told me that, too. And from local Hamiltonians, a couple of smiles. Sandra Harrington in letters to the editor in The Spectator on Tuesday, March the 23rd. "A letter writer is proud to live in a city where homeless people can scramble out of their plight. The fact is, there is absolutely no need for homelessness in Hamilton. Landlords welcome single tenants in Ontario Works because the rent is paid directly to them. You can't starve in Hamilton with all the soup kitchens around. I eat at the Good Shepherd because I'm too lazy to make dinner and clean up, and the food is excellent and balanced. The fact is, people stay at shelters in the Wesley Center because of one of two reasons. They prefer to spend their stipend on things other than rent, or they have mental addiction health issues. Absolutely no one is on the street because they cannot afford to rent. Ontario Works provides a little over $550, and rooms tend to go for $350 to $400. It's not fun, but it's absolutely not necessary to stay at a shelter for more than 28 days. I speak from experience." Now, it strikes me a few letters to The Spectator might be in order. I think that's letters at thespec.com. And from the big cheese at The Spectator himself, Robert Howard. "City Hall slam seems off base. A local artist's series of posters dumping on the City Hall renovation project and Councillor Lloyd Ferguson's role in that display a real ignorance of city processes." Graham Crawford, also a museum and gallery owner, says the renovation is spoiling the heritage building, citing the move of the building's cafe to the first floor and the replacement of marble cladding with concrete. He's laying all of this at Ferguson's feet, which ignores the fact that all decisions on the renovation went through council, on which Ferguson is but one vote. Making this a personal attack undermines whatever message Crawford wanted to get across. Ferguson, in fact, was not in favor of renovation. He supported a new city hall. There was a lively public and council debate on the use of concrete on the hall's exterior, but in the end, council decided collectively the city could not afford any new marble. As for the interior, there have in fact been huge efforts made to preserve heritage aspects. Moving the cafe to make it more accessible to the public hardly seems an offense. What taxpayers should be appreciative of is that the project is so far coming in some $4 million under budget and 6 months ahead of schedule. That's almost unheard of in public works projects. The councillor is a public official. Criticism comes with the job, but anyone who believes that the way ahead for this city is by being eternally negative needs to give their head a shake. Oh, Rob, I stopped putting my head under the covers to banish the monsters when I was about, oh, what, four? That's the news for Disrespect this week. Come back next week. There certainly will be more. If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. tune in at Showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.